I'm Jeff Sickinga, Executive Director of the Ashbrook Center, and this is The American Idea, where we discuss the ideas, people, and events that have made America what it is today. We believe that by understanding our history and our principles, we can better live up to the promise of the American founding and preserve our ongoing experiment in self-government. Welcome to The American Idea.
Thanks for joining us today for The American Idea. I'm Kara Rogers-Stevens, and I'm happy today to be joining The American Idea along with Jeff Sickinga as one of the show's hosts. I am an associate professor of history here at Ashland University. I specialize in the political and intellectual history of colonial and early Republic America, particularly the histories of slavery and abolition. In addition to my role as a professor here, I'm one of the directors of the Ashbrook Scholar Program at the Ashbrook Center, and I also teach in our master's degree program and in seminars for high school teachers around the country. Today, it is my great pleasure to welcome back John White, professor of American Studies at Christopher Newport University. John is the author or editor of 19 books and more than 100 articles, essays, and reviews about Abraham Lincoln, the Civil War, slavery and emancipation, and the U.S. Constitution. His book, A House Built by Slaves, African-American Visitors to the Lincoln White House, was co-winner of the 2023 Gilder Lehrman Lincoln Prize. And he's also the editor of the forthcoming book, A Great and Good Man, Rare Firsthand Accounts and Observations of Abraham Lincoln. He recently published a fascinating article in Real Clear History about slavery and free speech. And so today we're going to talk about a largely overlooked era of the suppression of this most fundamental political right. John, thanks so much for coming on the show again.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So tell us, what led you to write this article about free speech? Is this linked to an upcoming project of yours?
It's something I've been thinking about for a long time. I actually taught a seminar on free speech last spring for seniors here at Christopher Newport, and we looked at issues about free speech going all the way back to early modern England and then up through current Supreme Court jurisprudence. And as part of that seminar, I had the students read the Cooper Union Address by Abraham Lincoln, and then also some chapters of books about suppression of speech by pro-slavery Southerners when abolitionists were trying to speak out against slavery. And I think that that was really eye-opening for the students because they hear about debates that we have today about censorship in big tech or government censorship, and they didn't realize that it was going on in a lot of different eras of American history. So for them, we looked at, again, early modern England, and then we looked at the colonial era, like the Peter Zenger trial, and then the Sedition Act of 1798, the Civil War, World War I. I mean, The sad thing is that the history of free speech in America is actually one of a lot of lack of free speech. And so we drew those ideas out.
Yeah, my students are always a little horrified when I talk about the Alien and Sedition Acts and the ways in which it became dangerous to criticize John Adams. I believe there was somebody who was fined $100 and put in jail for making a comment about the size of the president's rear end.
Yeah.
So it's not a new thing for people to have the fear of attacking their political opponents publicly.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this article in particular that you've just written about slaveholders restricting free speech, I'm wondering, can you give us some background context for this? And you start with a really great provocative line. You say, in the years before the Civil War, slaveholders were the greatest threat to free speech in the United States. So for those who are unfamiliar with this era or slaveholders posing this threat, can you set the stage for us? What are the issues that are at stake in these antebellum years?
Yeah, so the slave system relied on violence to maintain itself. And so you see this in the plantation South. Actually, there was a great German theorist and college professor named Francis Lieber who said violence supports it and violence will be its end. And that was years before the Civil War. He was sort of predicting what would happen. Yeah. And slaveholders used violence in part because that was how you could maintain control, but then also out of fear. there was a constant fear among slaveholders of slave insurrection. And slave insurrections had been going on in this country for many decades before the Civil War. But then after you get the rise of abolitionism in the early 1830s and Nat Turner's rebellion in Southampton County, Virginia, where Nat Turner and his men killed 55 white Virginians, there's an immense fear of slave insurrection. And rather than look at slavery as an institution and violence used to keep it going as the cause for slaves' dissatisfaction in bondage, the white South says, oh, well, the reason they're doing this is because of the rise of abolitionism. And if you didn't have abolitionists sending their ideas down through the mail into the South, then slaves wouldn't become dissatisfied and free Black people wouldn't be dissatisfied. And so the solution that white Southerners came up with to deal with slave insurrection and servile war and violence by slaves against enslavers was, well, we need to suppress free speech. And so in the 1830s, they begin passing laws that make it that really impose draconian punishments upon people who speak out against slavery in the South. And so one of the laws I quote was a Louisiana law in the article, where if you spoke in a way that made slaves or free Black people dissatisfied with their station in life, you could get up to 21 years at hard labor. And when I teach this to my students, I say to them, you know, most of you are not even 21 years old yet. So imagine your entire lifetime in prison at hard labor for speaking out on something that today is so obvious to us, like, hey, I think slavery is a bad thing, but you could get up to 21 years at hard labor for that, or even death. And so that law was passed in Louisiana. It was copied in other states like Alabama and I think North Carolina. I think three or four states copied that law verbatim. And it was the South saying, we are going to do anything we can to stop criticism of our domestic institution, because we believe that criticism will undermine it and lead to servile insurrection and maybe the end of the United States.
So an issue that I'm immediately thinking of as you're describing this, so slaveholders are concerned that the reason for insurrection is slaves are hearing things from abolitionists. And if they weren't hearing these things from abolitionists, they would not be rebelling. Do slaveholders really believe that? Is that genuinely their fear that insurrections would not occur if it were not for abolitionism? Or is that, are they deceiving themselves a little bit here? Is there maybe a little bit something else going on psychologically as to a reason why slaveholders wanted to silence criticism of their system?
Yeah, I mean, I think they are deceiving themselves in that, you know, they often believe these myths that slaves were satisfied and happy in bondage. Yeah. And so, you know, it's these evil abolitionists who are persuading them that they're not happy. And, you know, I think there was self-deception there. I think a lot of the slaveholders really convinced themselves to believe that that's true. And part of that too, you know, prior to the rise of abolitionism in the 1830s, most slaveholders defend slavery as a necessary evil. Mm. They say, we recognize that slavery's bad, but we don't know how to get rid of it, and we're kind of stuck with it for now. And people like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, that's primarily their defense of slavery. They recognize it's evil, but they don't know how to get rid of it. After the rise of abolitionism, slaveholders really come to defend slavery as a positive good. They say slavery is good for African Americans. We Christianize them. We civilize them. They'd be in Africa killing each other in tribal wars, whereas we give them work to do, so they're not lazy. Like, they use those kind of defenses. And so I think there's a lot of delusion in the argument that slaveholders are making to defend slavery. But I think they really believe it. I mean, yesterday in my class, I had my students read Roger Taney's opinion in Dred Scott in 1857.
Oh, that's a great case. A terrible case, but a great one to read.
Yeah, and they need to see the arguments. And one of the things that Taney says is that Africans are made articles of merchandise whenever a profit can be made. So there's a benefit for white people. But then Tawney slides in this line where he says this is done for their benefit. Mm-hmm. And I pointed that out to my students so that students could see whether, I mean, I think he really believes it, that slavery is a positive good for the enslaved. And so they want to undermine any criticism that might come in and undermine the system.
And that's so interesting that you bring up Tawney, because, of course, he's terrible at history. He gives this account of American history in which, according to him, Africans had always been enslaved, and no one ever criticized the institution or questions its justice. Whereas if you look at the debates over the Constitution, there are concerns being raised. George Mason from Virginia says slavery is violence. It will lead to violent uprising. It is for the good of the entire nation that we should end the slave trade. So slaveholders, I think I agree with you. By the 1830s, there's a lot of self-deception, a lot of belief that what they're doing is good and justifiable, and they seem unable to deal with criticism on any level.
And on your point about Tawney being bad at history, Lincoln criticized Tawney in a speech in June of 1857, where he said the Dred Scott opinion was based on assumed historical facts that are not really true. And that's one of the things Lincoln often says when he gets into these debates over slavery. You can make your argument, but make sure it's rooted in fact. Lincoln says at one point in the Cooper Union address, you don't have a right to deceive people as a politician. Like, you have to root your arguments in truth.
If only all politicians believed that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I want to ask you more about Lincoln in a moment, but before we get to him, so we're in the 1830s. Southerners are enacting these laws restricting free speech. How did they get away with it? Isn't it unconstitutional to ban this kind of language or any kind of even a seemingly mild concern about slavery?
Yeah, so there's a couple aspects to that. The first is that the Bill of Rights at that point did not apply to the states. So the First Amendment will not be applied to the states until 1925 with a case called Gitlow versus New York, where the Supreme Court will do what's called incorporating the Bill of Rights into the 14th Amendment and say, even though the First Amendment says Congress shall not, and then the prohibitions on Congress, now after 1925, those prohibitions apply to the states. But in the 1830s, there was no sense that the First Amendment restricted state power. And in fact, in 1833, there had been a case called Barron versus Baltimore, where the Supreme Court under John Marshall explicitly said the Bill of Rights does not restrict the power of the states. So you couldn't necessarily claim that the state was violating your First Amendment rights because no one perceived the First Amendment as restricting the states in that era. The other thing is, even though many states had free speech provisions in their own state constitutions, the South came up with justifications for why these laws didn't violate free speech. So some of the more extreme ones would say, well, it's treason to speak out against slavery like this. And those arguments didn't gain much traction, but some people made them. Some would say, well, it's seditious libel to speak out against slavery because that's speech against the government, and this speech might undermine and overthrow the government, so it's seditious libel. Other people said, well, when you criticize slaveholders, it's group libel. And so you're not allowed to libel someone. You can't libel a group. And then other people said, if you're criticizing a specific slaveholder, you're involved in libel of a person, and your libelous speech is not protected. And it's interesting, actually, the very famous abolitionist William Lloyd Garrison was imprisoned for, I think, about 49 days in Baltimore because he was convicted of libeling a slaveholder in an editorial he wrote. And so these were the kind of justifications that slaveholders could use to say, we have a right to critique this speech or to circumscribe it because you're libeling us or you're going to overthrow the government, sedition's not protected. And Garrison's response, while he was in prison, he wrote an account of his trial and what happened to him. And Garrison's response was, free inquiry is the essence, the lifeblood of liberty. In other words, I, as a journalist, need to be able to inquire into the actions of slaveholders, and you shouldn't be charging me with libel for it.
Wow. Yeah, that leads me to my next question. How many abolitionists ended up in jail because of these laws? How stringently were they enforced? Was it possible to crack down on every offense against one of these free speech laws?
It's a great question. I honestly don't know how many were imprisoned or tried. I know there were some cases where Northerners, people in New York, for instance, were violating these Southern laws, and Southern states tried to have them extradited, and the Northern states in these cases refused to extradite them. So the governor of New York, for example, in the 1830s said, no, we're not going to send a New Yorker to Alabama for trial. I don't know the numbers. One of the things that's really interesting about this is that there's mob violence that kind of fills in the gaps. Mm-hmm. So people who speak out against slavery are sometimes killed by mobs. And then there's also, we suspect that some abolitionists may have been murdered. Like David Walker was a Black abolitionist who published a pamphlet called His Appeal. And there's a lot, he died very young, and there's speculation that he was poisoned. And yeah. So, you know, if the laws weren't enough, there were other ways to make sure that you could try to silence abolitionist speech.
Wow. And I think it is fair to say that there are not very many abolitionists publishing or speaking publicly freely in the South.
That's right. It's primarily, you know, in the 1830s, it's primarily Northerners. And in 1835, they start a mail campaign where they're going to just mail their pamphlets and their newspapers and things into the South. And that really sets the South off, because they see this as almost like an invasion of ideas from the North into the South. And for a while, they get some post offices to say, we're not going to mail this stuff anymore unless someone in the South is subscribing to it. Andrew Jackson, as president, actually in his annual message to Congress, advocates for a law that would inflict severe penalties on abolitionists who mail things into the South. Wow. And so ultimately, that law doesn't get passed, but it shows how exactly your point. It's primarily Northerners who are sending these written ideas into the South. Of course, in the South itself, you have slaves who may not be literate and aren't writing, but are speaking against slavery amongst each other and how they might run away or resist. But the written abolitionist movement's coming out of the North.
Wow. So tell us about Abraham Lincoln and his role in all of this. How did he respond to these Southern attacks on free speech? What was his philosophy when it came to free speech?
So you begin to see it in 1838 in a speech that I'm sure many of your listeners know, the Lyceum Address. And even though he doesn't necessarily talk about free speech in that speech, and he was only 29 years old when he delivered it, which is really remarkable, but he looks at the mob violence that's going on around the country, much of which is directed at abolitionists or African Americans, and he shows how that's undermining the foundations of the nation, that the founders had given us a series of political institutions that he says are more conducive to the protection of civil and religious liberty than any the world has known. And so, for example, he points to the murder of Elijah Lovejoy. Elijah Lovejoy was a newspaper editor originally from Maine, moves to Alton, Illinois, and he sets up a newspaper there, and he publishes abolitionist ideas in the newspaper. And the leading citizens of Alton go to Lovejoy on several occasions, and they try to reason with him to stop and tell him, you should stop publishing this incendiary material. And Lovejoy refuses because he says, I have a right to free press. And on three occasions, mobs go and they destroy his printing press and they throw it in the Mississippi River. And on the fourth occasion, he's in his building with some other allies. And they come and they put a ladder onto the side of the building. They climb to the roof. They set it on fire. Lovejoy comes out. He gets shot and killed. One of the rioters gets shot and killed in the process as well. And Lincoln reads about this. And that sort of thing is terrifying to him. that mobs could do this in the free state of Illinois to an editor. And so, you know, he gives this speech in 1838 calling for law and order. Obey the law. If there's a bad law, work through the system to change the law. But don't take the law into your own hands, because when you do that, you run the risk of alienating the affections of the people towards their government and then undermining the government and leading to the loss of the system of political and religious liberty that we have. And so, again, I don't think he uses words like free speech or free press in that address, but his audience would have known that he is advocating for people whose rights had been denied. And so I think that's one of the earliest statements of Lincoln's on that subject.
That's actually very scary that it wasn't just Southerners who were restricting free speech and attacking abolitionists, that this could happen in the North. That indicates that there was kind of widespread animosity toward abolitionists and a desire to make them just shut up and go away and stop causing trouble.
That's right. And today, you know, we look back at that era and we see the abolitionists as the good guys. They're the ones who saw the immorality of slavery and were fighting for freedom and fighting for the principles of the Declaration of Independence. The governor of Illinois in the 1830s, when he talked about evil in the issue of slavery and used the word evil, he was referring to the abolitionists. And so it should be kind of mind-blowing to us how backwards it was, even in the free North. And I think it should complicate the way that we think about this period and teach it to our students. We can't just teach it of, you know, it was the free North against the slave South. It's much more complicated than that.
Before we continue with our conversation, I'd like to have one of our faculty members tell you about a special documents-based graduate program for teachers of American history, government, and civics.
Hi, this is John Moser, chair of the Master of Arts in American History and Government program at Ashland University. If you are an educator who teaches U.S. history, government, or politics, our program may be just what you've been looking for. Our approach is to emphasize primary sources, since we think the best way to study the past is to read the words of those who lived it. We have a distinguished faculty made up of professors from both Ashland University and from colleges and universities across the country. And they're not there to lecture to you. We think it's better to learn through conversation about the documents. Ours is a hybrid program with two different types of seminar. The first are our week-long intensive in-person courses during the summers on the beautiful campus of Ashland University. The second are our live synchronous online seminars offered throughout the year. So if you're a social studies teacher and you're looking to deepen your understanding of America's past and its politics, please check out the Master of Arts in American History and Government program. You can do that by visiting tah.org/programs.
Absolutely. So at a time when a majority wants to silence a minority, for being troublemakers, for expressing an unpopular opinion, Abraham Lincoln stands up for free speech rights. And as he's running for president, in particular in your article, you quote Lincoln arguing that actually stifling free speech in a democratic country is dangerous. Can you tell us more about that? What were Lincoln's concerns and in what ways was he trying to protect the right of free speech?
Yeah, so this is a speech Lincoln gave in February of 1860. So it's before he gets the Republican nomination for president by a couple of months.
Okay.
He's invited to go to New York City to give a speech. It was originally going to be at Henry Ward Beecher's church, but I think it got too big for that venue. So they moved it to the Cooper Union in downtown Manhattan. And this was a big opportunity for Lincoln because it was going to be his first major Eastern audience. So this is his way to really project his message and his image to people who could be selecting the next president, or at least the next Republican nominee for president. And so he gives a very long speech, and I actually assign it to my students, and I know they hate it when they read it because the first part of it, the first half, is really tedious. Yeah. But when we discuss it in class, I blow through the first half. Yeah. But the speech is basically in three parts. The first part is the first half, and it's a history lesson. And Lincoln
people had longer attention spans in those days.
They did. They certainly did. And it's
they
funny.
Listen to a 3-hour-long speech and no problem.
Well, and I always read them this diary entry that a teenage girl wrote on the day after the speech. And in the diary, she writes that she came down to breakfast and the speech had been reprinted in the New York Times. And her grandfather asked her to read it to them while they were having breakfast. And so she did. And then she concluded her diary entry that it said it must have thrilled men's souls. And I read that to my students and I say, look, I know you struggled to get through the speech and it was boring to you, probably. This girl who's younger than you, when she read it to grandpa, she concluded it was thrilling.
Wow.
And I hope that that gives them a different perspective of the speech. So in short, the first half of the speech is the first part. And it's just a history lesson where Lincoln shows that the founding fathers believed that Congress could restrict slavery from going into the territories.
Okay.
And in a very long and tedious way, he makes this argument. The second part of the speech, Lincoln talks to Southerners. And I can give you some of the exact language that he uses, because some of it's very powerful. But he makes the argument that Southerners are doing a disservice to themselves by silencing abolitionists and by simply calling Republicans names, that it would be better for them if they engaged in debate. And then the third part of the speech, Lincoln speaks to Republicans. And this is the shortest part. But in this part, he says essentially, you've got to believe that the arguments we have are right, that they're winnable. And even though you might be slandered, or you might be jailed, or you might be treated terribly or violently, you've got to stand up for what you believe and make the case. And he concludes the speech with a very famous line where he says, neither let us be slandered from our duty by false accusations against us, nor frightened from it by menaces of destruction to the government, nor of dungeons to ourselves. And then in all caps, he says, let us have faith that right makes might. And in that faith, let us to the end dare to do our duty as we understand it. So normally the aphorism is might makes right.
That's right, yeah.
Whoever has the most power can get their way. And Lincoln is saying, no, it's the opposite. First, come up with the arguments. Make rational, logical, strong arguments. And he gives them the argument. Then he says, try to get the other side to listen. And then he says to his side, be willing to take the risk. Be willing to step out on a limb and make the case. Even though you might get trashed by the Twitter mob, like, go out and make the case. And, you know, it's interesting. There's a Harvard law professor who about 3 years ago published a book just criticizing Lincoln for breaking the Constitution. And in that book, this Harvard law professor calls this speech basically incoherent. And I think Harvard law professor, and that's my word, but that's essentially what he says. And I think that Harvard law professor was missing what Lincoln was doing. He had an argument that he was making, and it took him an hour to make it. But when you see it broken down in this way, I think it just makes for such a powerful statement in favor of the free exchange of ideas rather than silencing your opponents.
Yeah, one line that you quote in your essay, Lincoln seems to be responding directly to the Southern belief that silencing criticism of slavery would prevent violence. So their thesis is insurrection will occur if abolitionists are permitted to criticize slavery. The abolitionists are the ones whose speech will lead to violence. Lincoln seems to respond with a warning that stifling free speech may actually lead to violence. And the precise wording from Lincoln is, how much would you gain by forcing the sentiment which created that anti-slavery feeling out of the peaceful channel of the ballot box into some other channel? What would that other channel probably be? And then he mentions John Brown and asks how many more John Brown type situations would there be? What do you make of what Lincoln is doing here?
Yeah, so that's a really powerful line. And let me go up a little bit above where you were. He says, human action can be modified to some extent, but human nature cannot be changed. There is judgment and a feeling against slavery in this nation, which cast at least 1.5 million votes. And I want to pause for a second there. I'm going to write about this at some point. Lincoln loved to use this phrase of judgment and feeling, or think and feel. And he used it, as far as I can tell, in two different contexts. He used it when speaking about romantic relationships, and he used it when talking about the advocates for freedom. And when he says judgment and feeling, or think and feel, I think he's saying the whole person, your heart and your mind, are fully invested in this. And so Lincoln's saying there's 1.5 million voters in this country in 1860 who in their heart and their mind oppose slavery. And then he says, you cannot destroy that judgment and feeling, that sentiment, by breaking up the political organization which rallies around it. I mean, the Democrats would have loved to have gotten rid of the Republican Party and just not had to fight those political battles. And how do you do it? Well, you throw Republicans in jail if they speak out against slavery. And there's talk of that Stephen Douglas, Lincoln's main political opponent, was going to introduce a sedition bill into Congress, a federal law restricting anti-slavery speech. Wow. And then we get to the point where you read, and he says, you know, even if you could silence that whole political organization, what would you gain by it? Because if people have the judgment and the feeling, the heart and the mind, that they believe slavery is wrong, they're not going to just get rid of it. Like, it's not going to just dissipate and disappear. So some may silence themselves, and Tocqueville talks about tyranny of the majority. So some may do that. But if there's 1.5 million people who, with their hearts and their minds, believe slavery is wrong, they're going to act. And Republican government gives people a peaceful way of expressing their opinions. And if you deny people a place in the small r Republican or small d Democratic system, then they have nowhere left to turn but violence. And so he then says, what would that other channel probably be? Would the number of John Browns be lessened or enlarged by the operation? And this gets back to what we were talking about at the beginning, that slavery was protected through violence, and slaveholders were constant in perpetual fear of violent slave insurrection. And he's saying to them, you know, you think you can stop violence by silencing us. If you silence us, you're actually going to get more people like John Brown who say, I have nowhere left to turn than to try to have violent slave insurrection. So it's a very stark warning to the South that obviously they don't heed, but I think it's a poignant one.
Of course, the huge irony here is that violence would come to America as a result of this disagreement. And what a shame it is that free speech and reasonable conversation and the ballot box were not able to solve this issue of slavery, that ultimately it slavery was a violent system that ended with violence.
Yeah. And that's as it was predicted, again, by people like Lieber. They knew that that's what would happen.
Absolutely. Heck, even Thomas Jefferson predicted that in the 1780s.
That's right.
Yeah. How long can God withhold his judgment from us for this unfair system, this unjust system?
That's right.
So, but one question that I do have to ask, so we're presenting Lincoln here as an advocate for free speech, an advocate for the principles of the ballot box. Didn't he restrict free speech himself later on?
He did. And this is a complicating factor during the Civil War. So we don't know how many people Lincoln arrested or allowed the military to arrest during the Civil War. It's estimated anywhere from 14 to 30,000 people, which is a lot of people. And to be precise, per capita, Jefferson Davis arrested just as many in the Confederacy. So both the North and the South were instituting these civil liberties policies.
Huh.
What we know now is that most of the people Lincoln was arresting were somehow either materially helping the Confederacy or hurting the Union war effort. So they're people who would have been arrested anyway, except for that the civil courts just couldn't handle all these cases during the Civil War. So these are saboteurs, bridge burners, spies, smugglers, people aiding desertion, you know, draft dodgers. These are people who are hurting the war effort. That said, there were people who were arrested during the war. There were at least 125 newspapers that were suppressed during the war. And I've written extensively about this. And I criticized Lincoln in some of my books for some of the actions that were taken by his administration. I wrote a book, about 12 or 13 years ago, called Abraham Lincoln and Treason in the Civil War, The Trials of John Merryman. And as part of that book, I include a little aside about a former congressman from Ohio, and he's probably the most famous, but he named Clement Vallandigham, who was arrested for disloyal speech during the Civil War. And it's interesting because Vallandigham actually wanted to get arrested. He was hoping to win the Democratic nomination for governor. And he wasn't the Democrats' first choice. So he went out and started giving incendiary speeches that should have been protected, but he got arrested by the military. And his hope was he would become a martyr and then win the Democratic nomination. And what he didn't have in store, or what he didn't realize was in store for him, was that the Union general who ordered his arrest, Ambrose Burnside, wasn't going to just arrest him and hold him for a little while. Burnside shipped him to Cincinnati, had him tried before a military commission, and then Vallandigham was sentenced to hard labor for the duration of the war. Now, I think that's a gross violation of Fifth and Sixth Amendment rights and First Amendment rights. Lincoln was in a difficult position here. On the one hand, Lincoln found out about the arrest of Vallandigham in the newspapers. He didn't order it. He didn't, you know, preemptively say, go ahead and do it. Yeah. He found out about it. And so now the position he was in is, do I undermine my military commander, or do I set this guy, or do I keep him in jail? And Lincoln kind of triangulated, and he figured, well, if Vallandigham likes the South so much, we'll just send him there. So rather than send him to prison at hard labor for the duration of the war, which who knows how long that's going to be, he sent Vallandigham down to Tennessee. The Confederates there are like, we don't want this guy. And Vallandigham didn't actually want to be in the Confederacy either. He wanted to be governor of Ohio. Eventually, he crosses the lines, makes his way to Richmond, escapes through the blockade, goes to Canada, and settles in Windsor, Canada, across the river from Detroit. He gets his wish. He gets the Democratic nomination for president, or sorry, for governor. But then he loses in a landslide. And
wow!
In 1864, Vallandigham comes back into the United States, and Lincoln essentially orders his commanders, like, leave this guy alone. He does more damage to his own side with his incendiary speech. We do more damage to our side if we arrest him again. And Vallandigham was not arrested again after he came back into the country. And so, you know, I always have kind of conflicted feelings about Lincoln and free speech, because on the one hand, he goes from being such a strong advocate for free speech before the war to then having this kind of checkered mixed record during the war. On the other hand, it is wartime. And
that's right.
He has to worry about people who are undermining the war effort, and he has to handle all these different issues. And some things that are unfortunate do wind up happening in the course of the conflict. And, you know, my personal view, and again, I talk about this in my book on the subject, my personal view is that Lincoln was probably justified in suspending the writ of habeas corpus and arresting people and holding them without charges. I think he crossed the line when he started using military courts to try people like Vallandigham. And the irony there is Lincoln actually signed a law that Vallandigham had opposed that should have prohibited the trial of people like Vallandigham. And Lincoln just ignored it. And so in my book, I kind of point to that irony that Vallandigham opposed the law that should have protected him, and Lincoln ignored the law that led to Vallandigham's military trial. It's a complicated story, to be sure.
And it really points to this tightrope that Lincoln had to walk as this leader trying to keep the Union together in a time of such division and protect the Union as it was under violent attack.
Right.
While upholding these values, these democratic values and rights and freedoms. I do not That's envy right. him his task there.
Yeah, it was certainly, I mean, it's the darkest period in American history. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. Wow. Well, As we draw our conversation here to a close, what would you like modern listeners to take away from this contest that you're describing here, when slaveholders were the greatest threat to free speech? How do the lessons of this antebellum era maybe apply to our democracy today?
It's a great question. I think, you know, we live in a culture today where a lot of Americans no longer believe in free speech, or they believe in it as long as there are limitations on it. And so, you know, people will say, well, hate speech is not protected, or other kind of speech is not protected, or misinformation, however that's defined, is not protected. And I would just challenge those ideas by saying, you don't need a First Amendment to protect popular speech, and you don't need a First Amendment to protect the speech that the government wants protected. You need a First Amendment to protect unpopular speech. Oh. And so I'll give you two quotes that I think are very helpful, and they come from this debate in the years before the Civil War over the nature of free speech and why it's needed. The first one is from Frederick Douglass. I originally had this in my article, but I had to cut it because the article was a little long. And in December of 1860, Douglass gave a speech in Boston. And this is part of what he said. He said, "No right was deemed by the fathers of the government more sacred than the right of speech. Liberty is meaningless where the right to utter one's thoughts and opinions has ceased to exist. That of all rights is the dread of tyrants. It is the right which they first of all strike down. They know its power." And then Douglass said, "Slavery cannot tolerate free speech. 5 years of its exercise would banish the auction block and break every chain in the South."
Wow.
For Douglass, he understands anti-slavery speech was unpopular, and that's why it needed protection.
Yeah.
And the framers of the Constitution and of the Bill of Rights understood that. He says you need to protect unpopular speech. And if you could just show the evil of slavery and allow people's minds to be changed, he says slavery couldn't last 5 years. And earlier in the debate, I think this was from the 1830s, there was an abolitionist named William Ellery Channing. And this is just a little bit of what he said. He said, "Of all powers, the last to be entrusted to the multitude of men is that of determining what questions shall be discussed. The greatest truths are often the most unpopular and exasperating, and were they to be denied discussion till the many should be ready to accept them, they would never establish themselves in the general mind. The world is to be carried forward by truth, which at first offends, which wins its way by degrees, which the many hate and would rejoice to crush." I mean, how relevant is that to us today, that you're not going to win people over just automatically? You have to slowly be able to make the argument. And at first, when you're making the case, some people are going to be offended by it, and they're going to want to crush it. They're going to hate what you have to say. But he says, you shouldn't let the majority or the government decide, well, that question's out of bounds, that topic's out of bounds, because he says the greatest truths at first are unpopular, but slowly and slowly they'll win the day. And so I think these abolitionists have a lot to teach us today. And we love to praise the abolitionists for their hatred of slavery. We often forget or don't even know that they also were powerful advocates for the free exchange of ideas. And that part of their legacy today is almost just as important as their fight for freedom for the enslaved.
Wow, that is powerful. And I think what perhaps is the greatest takeaway for me, from this conversation is that the abolitionists used to be called the bad guys. Now it is uncontroversial to think of them as the good guys. But just because a majority of people believe something to be true doesn't mean that you should silence your opponents. You have to allow the free exchange of ideas to allow the good ones to rise to the surface and to convince people over time. Yeah. That's so interesting. Thank you so much, John, for writing this article and for spending your time with us this morning, describing it and explaining it to us. And to everybody listening, don't forget to check out John's books, such as A House Built by Slaves or his upcoming book, A Great and Good Man, about Abraham Lincoln, or his children's book called My Day with Abe Lincoln. The links are in the notes to this episode, and we look forward to interviewing you, John, about that Abe Lincoln book in an upcoming episode, if you would be willing to come back and speak with us again.
I'd be delighted. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining me today on The American Idea.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The American Idea. If you enjoyed this episode, remember to subscribe at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave a 5-star review. If you want to learn more or get involved in Ashbrook's vital work, visit our website, ashbrook.org.